Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Wages finally went up. Now let's see if we can keep that going. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdal, who is on assignment. It is Friday, January 6th. Good to have you with us on a tumultuous and busy news day. We are going to start the show the way we do most Fridays, with our wrap-up of the week that was. And joining me now are Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine and Neela Richardson, Chief Economist at Redfin. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Lizzie.
So I guess I want to know, now that we have this intelligence community report about this Russian hacking, and really they're saying, yes, it was in fact Russian hacking, does this now become an economic story? Is it an economic story? Is it an economic story, or is it still kind of in the political realm?
I mean, I think it's a political story, but I think bigger picture, it's absolutely an economic story. I mean, this is very real. This is our next big enormous threat in terms of security and also economic threat. I mean, this is, we've seen it with many hacks in the business world over the past couple of years, but I think we're just barely scratching the surface.
Neela?
Hacking is an economic story. We've seen it in our corporate institutions, our financial institutions. It hits the bottom line of every company. And we honestly need to build a wall of cybersecurity that prevents hacking from foreign entities.
Well, so when we think about that, I mean, I guess one of the questions here is, are we thinking long term or immediately changing things for this incoming administration? I don't know, Lee.
I think it's both. I mean, I think the incoming administration, we don't know what to expect. We don't know. There's so many unknowns. It's hard to know how they'll deal with this on top of everything else. But I think it's a very long-term issue. And I think it just requires so much more attention than we're giving it now. And that is both from the public and private sector.
Okay, well, now I'm going to give it even less because I'm going to switch to the hardcore economics of today, which was the jobs report. 156,000 jobs created, 4.7% unemployment. Neela, you are the economist here. The real bright spot was year-over-year wage increase. Is this the thing we've been waiting for?
It is, and what a wonderful baton to pass to the next administration. We have been waiting since the recovery to see a pickup in wage growth. It has been the leading story, even as we've added jobs at a fast clip every month, especially over the last couple of years. Wages were persistently stubborn and low, and this big pop in wage growth is a good sign that maybe we're on a trajectory finally towards improvement in real incomes.
Well, so how then, Lee, does that spin out into affecting, everybody's lives? Does it?
It's definitely a good sign. Wages, as Neela said, have been the stubborn thing that wasn't for a long time. And in fact, today it's funny that job creation and the rate were actually not as strong as they usually are.
Yeah.
So it's the exact opposite we usually see. But the general trend has been positive now for a long time. But I think the real question is, are there jobs for everybody anymore? I mean, our whole job landscape is changing. The middle class is still really threatened and shrinking. And I think I think there's still a lot of problems. And what we really need is plain old growth. I mean, that's also what's been so evasive for us. And
we
just need the economy to start humming again.
And Lizzie, just to add a little bit to Lee's point, over last year, we lost 45,000 manufacturing jobs. So clearly, this is not a broad win in every industry,
right.
And particularly not in the middle of the country where growth is still waiting to happen.
And those jobs are not because of outsourcing. They are because of technology. I mean, obviously, there's some due to jobs being shipped overseas, but this is a huge seismic shift. This is a once-in-a-century shift in our economy that we're still going to be adjusting to for a while.
We don't have a ton of time left, but I want to bring up this really interesting story that the Wall Street Journal reported this week about President-elect Trump's debt, we're talking debt from his businesses, sold and packaged off. People remember how that works from the housing crisis. But, oh my goodness, so many different banks and institutions own it. I mean, maybe someone listening owns it in their 401k and they don't know.
It's everywhere. It's amazing. I mean, you know, the Trump debt has been securitized, which if you think about it, makes sense because, you know, that's what happens to debt. But it is like the grand diffusion. I mean, it just lives everywhere. And so the question becomes, how do you possibly separate conflict of interest? You know, you just can't. Yeah.
This vetting process could have, well, the vetting process is going to be on the job. It could have happened earlier, but we didn't have the information. So as Trump assumes the presidency, that's when the vetting is going to occur. And it's so much easier to disentangle yourself from assets. You can sell off assets, but real estate debt is a whole nother ball of wax. It's hard to disentangle, especially when they're backed by your own personal name. And so this is a story that also will continue throughout the year.
All right. I want to thank you both. Neela Richardson from Redfin, Lee Gallagher from Fortune. Thank you both.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks, Lizzie.
On Wall Street today, so close to Dow 20,000, but no dice. Details when we do the numbers. We are going to stay with wages now. We talked about that in that jobs report we mentioned. Average hourly earnings went up 2.9% year over year. What that means in English is that a raise of about 75 cents an hour went to the average worker, meaning the average American worker now makes about 26 bucks an hour. Good news, long overdue to most of the people who watch this stuff, except inflation hawks. Mitchell Hartman reports from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Yeah, Americans' wages are finally going up, enough that pay increases are pulling substantially ahead of consumer price increases, which leaves more money in people's pockets to spend or save. And it's not just high-end jobs like software engineer and HR recruiter.
We see a lot of labor-style jobs with really fast pay growth.
Andrew Chamberlain crunches the numbers at online job site Glassdoor.
Warehouse associates, machine operators. These are people that are working in the supply chain of companies like Amazon and Walmart and doing big construction projects.
That supply chain work fits Philip Ron's job description. I pulled up behind his beer delivery truck on my way to work this morning and asked how he thinks things are going paycheck-wise.
I think it's starting to improve, but only just. I think they could go up more.
So wages going up too much, not something you're worried about?
No.
But this could become a worry for the Federal Reserve if companies are forced to raise their prices so they can keep raising their workers' wages 3% a year or more. Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute says there's no sign of that yet.
Wage growth is simply not putting any kind of worrisome upward pressure on inflation. So I think that, you know, we really need to wait it out and allow the economy to fully recover.
And as soon as there's a hint wages are pushing up prices, inflation hawks will be clamoring for the Fed to hike interest rates more aggressively and cool things down. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
For years now, we've been wowed by big numbers from China. So here's another. Beijing says a whopping $360 billion, with a B, dollars will be invested in renewable energy over 5 years. It's part of a broader shift in the green energy story from the rich world to emerging economies. And yeah, for all the benefits to future generations, this is to a very large degree a story about good old-fashioned self-interest. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
China's green investment is at the center of a larger global pivot. More clean energy money now flows to emerging economies than developed ones. A big reason is that countries like China and India are growing, so they need more energy, says Ethan Zindler at Bloomberg New Energy Finance.
Their demand for electricity is growing faster, and thus, as you need that extra marginal megawatt or gigawatt, wind or solar is now very ready to satisfy that need.
He says in some windy and sunny parts of the world, renewables are the cheapest sources of new energy, less expensive than coal or natural gas. China's big push is also a nod to economic reality. Its age of burning coal to power steel mills and sneaker workshops is ending. So clean energy could be the next trick, says Ranping Song of the World Resources Institute.
the government is trying to look for a new way to, you know, structure the economy so it actually can be healthier and can stabilize over the long term. I think that is one of the major driving forces.
When it comes to clean energy, Beijing is in it to win it. Chinese leaders often say their country came late to the Industrial Revolution, but just in time for the Energy Revolution. Sam Giel is research fellow at the University of Sussex in England.
They see China taking a leading position in exporting those technologies that will help the world to generate clean energy and to move into a position of kind of being a leading supplier.
That self-interest has little to do with global climate deals. So even if the U.S. backs away from its commitments, countries like China will likely power on. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
In just 2 weeks, we will, of course, have a new president, and along with him, a series of new cabinet secretaries. But today, we are looking back a bit with the outgoing Secretary of Education, John King, about his time in the department. Mr. Secretary, welcome.
Thank you.
You are, you know, on your way out the door. And I guess my first question for you comes actually from educators who have talked to our education correspondent. Now that the Common Core is in place, how long, they wonder, should it take before they start to see results?
Well, you know, it's certainly varied across the country. There are places where you're already seeing places like Washington, D.C., that's seen very significant gains in academic performance and graduation rates. States like Tennessee and Louisiana, where they're seeing promising early gains as a result of their work to support teachers around college and career-ready standards. We've got more students going on to college, a million more African-American and Latino students going on to college.
All of that sounds great. And I know that the Office of Civil Rights within the department has been a big priority for you. And yet, we know, you know, 80% of Latino students, 74% of Black students attend majority non-white schools. How do we have an equitable society and economy when schools in the U.S. are so segregated still?
You're exactly right. You know, we're more than 60 years past Brown versus Board of Education, and we actually have communities that are more segregated by race and by class today than they were 10 or 20 years ago. And I think, unfortunately, sometimes people think this is something that can't be changed. But in fact, this is a result of choices that are made around education policy and housing policy. What's promising is that there are more than 100 communities around the country that are engaged in voluntary school diversity initiatives, places like Louisville, Kentucky, where they are being very intentional in their school assignment strategies and in their work on housing to ensure that their schools are diverse.
I want to shift to higher education. There are thousands of students who went to schools, for-profit schools like Corinthian and others, who are still trying to get debt relief from the department. What happens to them on January 20th?
Well, we continue to work on reviewing the debt relief claims that we've received, and we're making progress in our work through those. But that work will need to continue into the next administration. That's not a partisan issue. That's not a question of one administration versus another. That's a right that students have, and the next administration will have a responsibility to keep going through those claims, reviewing them, and where students have been wronged, ensuring that they get the relief they deserve.
I know you haven't been in the job for a long time, but I wonder, what's your biggest regret? What do you wish you'd gotten done?
You know, well, two things. You raise the issue of school diversity. The president made a proposal, $120 million for a grant program called Stronger Together that would have incentivized and supported local voluntary efforts to improve school diversity. And we weren't able to persuade Congress to make that investment. The other is around early childhood. We know that high-quality early education has an 8-to-1, 9-to-1 return on investment. We've invested through this administration in the Preschool Development Grants Program, which is expanding access to high-quality pre-K in 18 states, tens of thousands of new seats. But it's not enough. Only about 40% of students are in public preschool programs. We have a lot more work to do to get to universal access for low- and middle-income students. The president proposed something called Preschool for All, Again, we weren't able to persuade Congress yet to make that investment. Public education is fundamental to the long-term success, not only of our economy, but of our democracy. And it's good for the country to see investment in public education and continuous improvement in public education.
Secretary of Education John King, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much. Thanks for the opportunity.
Coming up.
I think you always feel like you're a version of yourself that's somewhere between 13 and 16.
Even apparently when you're famous. Chris Hardwick on his new game show. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 64 points, 0.3%, to land at 19,963. The NASDAQ added 33 points, 0.6%, to end at 5,521. And the S&P 500 gained 7 points, 0.3%, to finish at 2,276. For the week, the Dow advanced 1%, NASDAQ climbed 2.6%, and the S&P 500 boosted 1.7%. So close, but no cigar. The Dow got to 19,999 today, and then backed away. Hitting 20,000 is a psychological barrier, but, you know, it's kind of fun to watch. Apple revealed it had missed sales targets for the first time since 2009 as the iPhone market slows, but don't feel bad. Still pulled in $215 billion. Apple chomped up 0.1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.42%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Exports are one of the few bright spots for farmers these days. Sales of soybeans overseas are so good they've almost single-handedly propped up that market. But the threat of a trade war and a Trump administration could devastate farmers' ability to export and has many of them wondering what's ahead. Mark Style reports.
Asia is the hot market for U.S. soybeans, especially China. Midwest farmers have a good pipeline to that market because of rail connections to Pacific Northwest ports. Grain companies this year have been busy loading soybean trains for overseas sales. At the CHS terminal in the tiny town of Ruthden in southwest Minnesota, grain manager Joel Wearing is watching a crew load soybeans onto a Burlington Northern Santa Fe train.
We're putting 3,700 bushels of beans on this car, and we're loading it anywhere from 3 to 4 minutes.
When fully loaded, the mile-long train will transport more than $4 million worth of soybeans to the West Coast.
Very huge. Without access to the export market, we'd be in some trouble.
And so would farmers. The U.S. sells about half its annual soybean crop overseas, total value about $20 billion. Bean prices aren't all that great right now, below break-even for many farmers. But prices probably would be a lot worse, minus the robust exports. That makes President-elect Trump a key figure for farm income. Many rural areas of the U.S. voted resoundingly for Trump, even though the candidate hammered the same trade deals that helped boost the farm economy in those areas. Trump has even threatened to impose trade sanctions on the largest buyer of U.S. soybeans.
China is ripping us off like nobody has ever seen.
That sort of talk can stir up unsettling flashbacks in the agricultural world. Farmers with long memories can still recall times when exports suffered after becoming entangled in world politics. One case was in 1980 when President Jimmy Carter halted grain sales to what was then still known as the Soviet Union in retaliation for its invasion of Afghanistan.
I am determined to minimize any adverse impact on the American farmer from this action.
Despite that presidential pledge, the nation's largest agricultural group, the Farm Bureau, said the embargo cost farmers $1 billion and permanently disrupted the grain trade. Now, farmers like Brad Nelson from southern Minnesota are waiting to see if the Trump administration acts on its tough trade talk. Nelson voted for Trump because he likes the idea of cutting government agricultural regulations and reducing health care costs. But he says if Trump really goes after China, that could hurt U.S. farmers.
Our exports to China obviously have exploded the last 10 or 15 years. We have good exports of grain and soybeans to Mexico, and, you know, we need to keep things like that happening.
Nelson, though, is optimistic. He says during the campaign, Trump's surrogates promised not to disrupt agricultural trade. He's counting on the new administration to fulfill that pledge. In Ruthven, Minnesota, I'm Mark Stile for Marketplace.
There's a new game show on NBC called The Wall, and no, it's not a reference to that wall. It more resembles the Japanese pachinko game, if you're familiar with that. Contestants have to answer trivia questions to win big money. LeBron James is one of the executive producers, and it's hosted by Chris Hardwick. He's founder of the Nerdist Empire, podcaster, host on Comedy Central, AMC, what feels like a million other jobs. Anyway, he came in to talk about the show. Hi, Chris.
This is Chris Hardwick.
All right, so...
You're listening to Marketplace.
I'm in charge.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Okay. So I want to ask you first off about this new show you're doing, because I watched some of it and it gave me a tremendous anxiety attack.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Can you explain what it is and also why you're doing it with LeBron James?
Well, the show is called The Wall, and it's pretty much based on pachinko, this Japanese vertical pinball. Right. Of course, I'm sure you've seen Plinko on Price is Right, or
like
you've
Plinko.
Seen other, you know, but it's all based on pachinko, which is still very popular. I went to Japan for my honeymoon, my wife and I, and they still have huge pachinko casinos there, to the extent that I bought one and had it sent back. I bought a Star Wars pachinko machine. They've become very advanced now. And LeBron was producing this show called The Wall, created by a guy named Andrew Glassman. And they came to me and said, hey, would you be interested in hosting this?
And you said, I don't have enough jobs?
Well, I said, well, I'm, you know, my schedule's very full at the moment. It's complicated at the moment.
I asked my Twitter feed what they wanted to know from you. And like four different people came up with some variation of, are you spreading yourself too thin?
No, I'm actually, I mean, I guess, I don't know. I don't know if I have the perspective to make... you know, an educated analysis of that. I don't think I'm spreading myself too.
Well, I mean, how would you know?
How would you know? But I do know that I'm a fairly excellent time manager. I started trying to construct this career that was built off of a bunch of sort of part-time jobs. Everything's very modular. And so sometimes when people see everything at once, they just think, oh, you're doing that all at the same time. But
right.
It's not everything is live. So it's all manageable.
So you have this little empire. You sold it.
Yeah, to Legendary Entertainment in 2012.
How would you describe what you do?
You mean on a macro scale
yeah.
or at Nerdist?
No, on a macro scale.
I don't know. I mean, when people say, what do you do? I say I'm a stand-up. You know, that's always my first love. That was always the thing that I started doing before anything else.
Someone made the somewhat snide comment, Ryan Seacrest for nerd.
You know what? It doesn't bother me. I see that all the time. I mean, Ryan's a nice guy, and he's definitely built – I mean, you know, he's – it's like an order of magnitude or what he's built. But also, you know, I don't ever take it as an insult. I take it as a compliment. Like, oh, you're doing a lot of different things and you happen to, you know, have this subset of culture that you are mainly focused on.
Yeah.
I mean, niche, but not – I don't think niche means small. I just think it means
How would you describe that subset of culture?
I mean, it's, you know, I would say nerd folk. I obviously, and this is ironic coming from someone who started a thing called Nerdist. I mean, I think the ubiquity of the word nerd now, it has somewhat, it's diluted its, you know, overall meaning. But it doesn't really bother me because a lot of people will complain, the proto nerds will complain, like, well, if you go to Comic-Con now, it's just all, you know, it's not just for comics anymore.
And it's big movies.
There's fringe people and what. And I kind of feel like, well, hey, I think it's great that it's inclusive, and I'm happy that it's more mainstream because, you know, we get a huge budget Avengers movie, or we'll get, you know, and so, or Deadpool. We'll get a Deadpool movie when that never would have happened before. But I think sometimes what happens, particularly in nerd culture, is that if you grow up feeling different, or if you're ostracized, and in my case, I feel I was very socially ostracized, then the reaction to that can be, well, I'm going to build a thing that no one else can come into. But my reaction was more, oh, I don't ever want anyone to feel ashamed about what they're into or feel cut out or left out. And so I think if you watch anything that I do or listen to anything that I do, I believe that it's all very inclusive.
I mean, come on, you're famous now. Do you still feel ostracized?
I think you always feel like you're a version of yourself that's somewhere between 13 and 16. The sort of projection of our ego is this 15-year-old kid. I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, I could perform, you know, I've done stand-up for 20,000 people. But if I'm at a party, sometimes one-on-one, I feel very uncomfortable talking to people one-on-one. I still feel that sort of, I shouldn't be here. I don't belong here. Everyone else knows something I don't. They're going to ask me to leave. But I still feel, I mean, Paul McCartney was on the podcast and he talked about having imposter syndrome until quite recently. I'm like, are you serious? But he really, you know, I still feel a lot of those things.
Chris Hardwick, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
This final note before we go today, we've brought you many stories about fake news and the roles companies like Facebook play in how they do or don't vet the information that's distributed on their networks. Today, we learned Facebook hired former TV journalist Campbell Brown to run its news partnership team. It's a little unclear exactly what that role encompasses. It's reportedly not to be an editor-in-chief, but more of a conduit between Facebook and journalists. Brown wrote on her own Facebook page that this is part of the transformation taking place in the news business. All right, that's it for us. Today, the Dow rose 64 points, 0.3%, to land at 19,963. The NASDAQ added 33 points, 0.6%, to end at 55.21. And the S&P 500 gained 7 points, 0.3%, to finish at 22.76. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitara Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you get Kai Rizdahl back next week. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.